Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
I thought I would talk tonight a little bit about the three treasures, what we know in Buddhism as the three treasures, and to talk a little bit about their meaning in today's world, in our modern life. As you know, the three treasures in Buddhism are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So the Buddha was the founder, of course, of Buddhism. And he was a very unusual person, a very remarkable human being. He did what very few people have the courage to do or the inclination to do. The Buddha gave up a life of luxury, very opulent luxury. He gave up great wealth, privilege. He gave up comforts and he gave up pleasures. Why would he do such a thing? Why would anybody do such a thing? It was because, despite all the luxury, he felt that his life was not satisfying. He did not feel satisfied by the life he was living in the palace, and he was troubled by that. I think he felt that there was something missing in his life, the way he was living. He did not feel authentic. He did not feel real. And, you know, perhaps he felt that his life was not useful in a very large sense. He was the prince of his father's kingdom, and he was on track to become the king someday, and perhaps he was doing some useful political things for his father and for the country. But he felt that his life his total life was not useful, not really useful. And in addition to that, as we know from what we read about the Buddha from the historians, he was concerned for the suffering of people. When he went out of the palace and into the local town, and he saw how ordinary people suffered in their daily life, and it concerned him very much. He was troubled by it. So he left what we call the good life, the life of luxury. He left that life for the beggar's life. He did it so he could find the truth. He wanted to find the truth about his life, and he wanted to help relieve the suffering of the world. You know, I believe there are people today who, in a less dramatic fashion, have the same feeling about their life and the same concern about the suffering of people in the world and the hardships that they all face, and they choose not to take advantage of the skills that they have and to have a luxurious life, but they might have a life that more directly is of benefit to people, and they choose a lifestyle that's very modest rather than a more opulent lifestyle that they could have if they decided to, there are people today with the same attitude of the Buddha. The Buddha lived a beggar's life. He lived in the forest and he lived with a few other monks in a very simple world, a very, very basic lifestyle. And he tried to focus on what was happening. What was the world all about? And he made some discoveries. Through his own effort, he made some discoveries about reality, the reality of life, and he made discoveries about the world. And he found confidence in his new way of living. And he gained understanding about the way things are and the way things were. And as we know from our reading of Buddha's history, the Buddha discovered the relief of suffering. And he eventually shared his understanding. He spoke with other people about what he discovered, and these teachings became what we know today as the Dharma. But in addition to his speaking with others and his teachings, he put great emphasis on practice. He encouraged people to make their own discoveries in the same way that he did. And he discouraged them from depending on him, from depending on his words. And as we know, the Buddha gained many followers because of his teachings and his selfless character. The second of the three treasures is known as the Dharma, the collection of teachings, or the truth that the Buddha discovered and that he explained to everyone who came to him. He discovered the reality of our everyday phenomenal world, the world of form. He's discovered the reality that exists beyond the appearances of the phenomenal world. And he encouraged us to make this discovery for ourselves, encouraging us that our discovery will relieve all doubts. We will realize the truth through our own effort. And this is why he emphasized practice so much. The third of the three treasures is the Sangha, or the community of followers. And in the very early days, when Buddha was still alive, and for quite some time afterwards, the practice that he advocated was limited to monks, people who gave up, men and then women, who gave up their ordinary life to live the simple life of a beggar. And they did it mostly solitary, or they were separate from society. These monks lived exclusive from the everyday world. Today, we don't do it quite that way. Today, more and more of our emphasis of our practice is on what we call the wider Sangha, the Sangha beyond the small group of monks. The Sangha, the third truth, includes many people with differing lifestyles, with different backgrounds. Many different people who come together in search of harmony and committed to creating harmony. That's the wider Sangha. So we are practicing today in the modern world as descendants and disciples of Buddha. We practice together in our Sangha just as if the Buddha were here with us. This is our attitude. So the Sangha, the third truth, started with Buddha's community of monks. But today, the Sangha includes any group practicing together. And that could include our family or the people we work with. And we expand our view of Sangha to everyone, everywhere, at all time. So the meaning of Sangha for us is that it exists everywhere. This is our understanding of the Third Noble Truth. Our Sangha includes everyone, everywhere. This is our attitude. So the Sangha is not just a friendly group of people. Actually, a true Sangha is a state of harmony. A community that supports each other and relieves suffering. And when we understand the meaning of our life and the meaning of our relationships, the activity of our Sangha is the activity of Buddha. So the Sangha is really the most important of the three treasures. It is how we carry on the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha's legacy. When we first come to practice, when we first start our practice, usually our interest is in gaining something for ourselves. Which I think was the Buddha's original interest. He felt that something was missing, and he went seeking to find it. When we too, when we first start to practice, our main interest is gaining something for ourselves to fill a gap that we think is there. And with our continued attention, with our continued emphasis on awareness over time, we discover the importance of aiming our practice away from ourselves and towards others. And we discover the true meaning of supporting and encouraging others. With our continued practice, little by little, the idea of gaining something for ourselves loses its urgency. And we sense a profound feeling practicing with others. And we understand how Buddha's teachings is expressed in harmony and activity of the Sangha. Like the Buddha, We come to practice because we want to know ourselves completely. We want to know our true self. Like him, we feel that something is missing. We want to know ourselves completely. This is, I believe, in my experience, this is what brings people to practice. We want to know ourselves completely, with nothing left out and nothing hidden or ignored. We want to know ourselves completely, both the encouraging aspects of ourself and those parts of ourselves that can be troublesome. In other words, we commit ourselves to know and accept ourselves in the very largest sense. Accept ourselves in the largest sense. And as you all know, this takes work. This is what we call practice. And we take care in our practice not to give in to hasty ideas and hasty activities, knowing that if we do give in, we will be lost in confusion. I think everybody here tonight, everybody in the world, loves a well-kept garden. We are all touched by the natural expression of plants and of trees. We are inspired by their harmony and their colors and their balance and their unity that is comprised of differences. And we take delight knowing that a well-kept garden is a refuge for birds, for butterflies and bees. And our love extends beyond a well-kept garden, but for nature itself, a refuge for all those living things. And in this love for the natural world, we find a very calming and fulfilling and a very wide feeling. We feel we are in communion with some unspoken truth. As you know, in Japan, Buddhist practice influenced gardens. Well-kept gardens are part of the temple complex. And when we nurture our garden, it is an expression of our spirituality. So if you have a garden at your home, or you help take care of a garden, you know that it takes work to keep a garden fresh and to keep a garden alive and to enable and allow the changes that continually occur. We become part of that change when we take care of the garden. And we have to watch what we do, and we have to learn to know what to do. And with experience, we will know how to take care. Our Sangha is like that. Our Sangha comes into balance and into harmony when everyone makes a selfless effort to support the Sangha. In that way, we create an inspiring garden, inspiring to whoever comes and meets us. Our Sangha is an expression of something very great. So when we work in the garden and when we work with the Sangha, we feel connected with our universal nature. When we create and care for our Sangha, we cannot feel cut off or alone, because this creating and this caring is the expression of our true spiritual self. We have a chant in our Sangha, in our practice. We say, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, and I take refuge in Sangha. This taking refuge is not some kind of worship or some kind of adoration. To take refuge in the three treasures is to trust. And we make our effort guided by something we trust. When we take refuge in the Buddha, we are guided by his example and his teachings. When we take refuge in the Dharma, we are making our best effort to live in the truth. When we take refuge in the Sangha, we trust its members, who are our deepest friends. As we know, Buddha's teaching emphasized that human suffering comes from desire, which in turn is based on ignorance of the true nature of the phenomenal world. But this ignorance that is spoken about in the scriptures, this ignorance is not about not being intelligent or having only a little mental capacity. The ignorance that we speak about in Buddhism is the result of maintaining a very narrow view of the world. It has nothing to do with our fundamental intelligence. Ignorance is the result of a very narrow worldview, as if we were living in a very long tunnel where we can't see the light at the end, and where we cannot see or be aware of the world around us, and we cannot feel intimacy and connection. This is ignorance of our natural state. So what is known in Buddhism as ignorance is the opposite of being absorbed in the wide garden. And so cannot recognize the true nature of things. So this narrow worldview is as if we were living in a dream world. And it naturally leads us to thinking and behaving foolishly, even though we may have great intelligence. So, if we want to emphasize the Sangha, our community, if we want to place our trust in the Sangha, we have to have a wide worldview. We have to come out of the tunnel. We have to see the world as it is, without distortion. And this is how we will appreciate the Dharma. So we create Sangha by practicing with others, by practicing with each other. And of course, practice begins with our Zazen, by sitting with each other. And the practice extends to in giving encouragement and to support to each other. Encouragement and support in all aspects of relationships. Sangha is our harmonious working together. And it begins by expressing gratitude for the support given to us by others. I think everyone aspires to having to living an enlightened life. But we have to understand what this idea of enlightenment really means. It is not about ecstasy or living in some mysterious state above all others. Enlightenment means having a warm feeling and a deep joy from having a very wide worldview, so that we have the feeling that now I see things truly. When we feel that way, we can accept whatever happens with a very smooth mind. Suzuki Roshi once said that enlightenment is the maturity of your experience of everyday life. And he further said, the true experience of Zen is mutual communion. We can refine our practice through the cultivation of our Sangha, through our honesty and our give and take in our relationships. By practicing mindfulness and patience and goodwill, evenly, without likes or dislikes, engaging with each other with a very wide worldview and a very big mind. So, does anybody have any questions? Dennis? Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Talking about Sangha, you have observed the Canon Do Sangha for, half a century or so. And I know that people come and go, and I'm sure there's kind of an ebb and flow of you know, various reasons. But would you be able to kind of say how would you characterize a Sangha over, you know, a half a century? What have you learned from watching a Sangha over such a long period of time?
Well, our Sangha and all Buddhist Sanghas are comprised of many different people of different backgrounds, different experiences, different skills, different interests, different motivations, very different. So when we first come together, or when new people approach the Sangha and consider if they want to join or how they want to become part of it, we have to be, one of the key features of Sangha is learning to be patient with people who have not yet joined the Sangha and may appear to be different than the people who are already in the Sangha. So one of the key features of Sangha that newcomers notice is our patience. The patience that our community members have for, you know, those rough spots that occur in our lives and in our relationships with each other. How we mindfully take care of those rough spots, and how we are committed to this notion of taking care. And this is what we emphasize in our Sangha. And this is the example we try to set when new people approach. Without lecturing them about it, except maybe me lecturing you right now, without lecturing people about the need for a taking care attitude, we try to demonstrate it. We try to live it. We try to live it in such a way that people develop a feeling for it, so they don't rely on an explanation of what it means. The greatest treasure of Kanon Do and of all Buddhist communities, you know, the fourth treasure can be the taking care attitude of the community. It's part of Sangha, how we take care of each other, how we express this taking care attitude wherever we go. And it requires attention and patience and encouragement, because we are always changing, because the community has an ebb and flow of people coming in and people going away. So we pay attention, we're always attentive, and we take care of each other. This is our attitude. And we hope that newcomers will absorb what we are trying to do and have a feeling of Sangha. It doesn't always go smoothly. Sometimes there are rough spots, but that's life. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you.
Diane?
Thank you for your talk, Les. You said You talked about practice and how through practice we make our own discoveries. So what's the role of our teacher if we have to make our own discoveries?
Janitorial. The first duty of the teacher is to be there, to show up. And hopefully by that showing up demonstrates to everybody else that there is a continuity to our practice, and there is at least one person who can be relied on to always be there. That's the starting point. That suits me perfectly because I don't have any special, charisma or great wisdom or intelligence, or I don't have any of that to offer, but I do know how to show up. And everybody knows how to show up. Anybody can show up. You just show up. You don't hesitate when it's time to be there. You just show up. That, I think, is the role of the teacher.
Well, thank you for showing up.
Carolina?
So, Bess, you show up, you've never been late, and your robes are always nice. That's a good example.
Yeah, we should do that for each other.
Yeah.
Hi, Nick.
Hey, Les, it's so good to see you, and it's so good to see the rest of the Canando Sangha.
What's up with you?
Nothing much. I'm just here in Kansas, so it's so wonderful to see all of you. I remember when I was growing up and I was going to Catholic school, we learned about the different kinds of sins in the world. And we had different rankings of sins. Some were really, really bad that we called mortal sins, and some were slightly lesser. We called those venial sins. And I just thought it was very interesting how we had this range of the gravity and severity of different kinds of sins. And when I look at what I've learned from the Buddhist traditions, their understanding of sins is somewhat different. And I think the closest thing Buddhism would have to what Roman Catholics would call the mortal sins, the worst things you could do. I recall that Buddhism had what they called the five crimes, or the five gravest offenses, which was killing your father, killing your mother, killing an arhat, someone who's enlightened, killing or shedding the blood of the Buddha. And then the fifth one was causing division in the Sangha. And it always struck me that of those five, if you want to call them sins or offenses or crimes, that causing division in the Sangha was seen as equivalent to murder or inflicting bodily harm. And I'm wondering if you can give some thoughts about that. Why is something like that on that serious a level?
Well, from what you said, the Sangha is seen as a living body. not just the collection, but a living body of very dedicated people who have a big heart. Sangha has a big heart. So when, if we were to intentionally create harm in the Sangha, we are attacking that big heart and that great being that has no bounds. The Sangha has no bounds. And I think the Buddha and his followers appreciated the Sangha as a great being, and rather than a collection of people. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Laz.
There is a question in the chat.
The chat?
Yeah, there's someone called a sage, S-A-G-E. So, interesting. So, I didn't find the sage here. I'm reading that. In talking about newcomers, you mentioned a few times that there are sometimes difficult integrations into the Sangha and the folks that are a little bit different. What has been a source of friction in the past for Canada? What can we do to make things easier for everyone involved?
So this is a question that's directed at everybody.
Yeah.
Because it asks, what can we do to make things easier for everyone involved? So I want to invite all of you to comment on that. What can we do to make things easier? Or, well, to make things easier for everyone involved. But to answer the I've been asked to answer the first part of the question is, what has been the source of friction in the past for Canada? You know, sometimes over the past 50 years or so since we started, occasionally someone will come to practice and they'll be carrying with them some anger from their early days. And sometimes that anger, you know, rubs other people the wrong way. And we have to learn to smooth it out. And it's just inevitable. It's rare in Canada. It hasn't happened all that often. When it does happen, it can be a cause of concern for a time, but we respond to it. So I'd like to invite all of you to maybe comment on how do we respond when anger appears in the Sangha. As we know, it inevitably will in the world. What can we do to make things easier for everyone involved? Would anybody like to say something about that? Yes, May.
Respect. Because that was a really raw emotion. I think of just respect anger, whatever it is. I know it's easy to say, but
Carolina.
Traditionally, we say that patience is the response to anger.
The practice of patience, yes.
Compassion, trying to understand.
Uh-huh.
Not responding with more anger.
Okay. You're on a roll, Carolina.
What you said about showing up, and I think this idea of respect and compassion and all of that, and all of the rest of the precepts and all of that, simply being willing to be present for someone's anger and to be with them sometimes, I think, is a, you know, with understanding that it will pass, and that, or that the situation will change inevitably, eventually, that patience I know I've been contending a lot with that, the equanimity, like being able to accept the, that not everyone views views things the same way, and that we don't always know we never know the whole story. So, sometimes we do have to remove ourselves from a situation for a little while and then come back. The ebb and flow, I guess.
Yeah.
So, Les, you asked this question, what should we do with anger? This came to my mind that we should eat it and sit on it and see what it gives us. But there is something in there that is for the benefit of ours, for us to look at ourselves. Because anger comes from loss or from pain. And that's what I was thinking. I'm saying it in a very weird way. Don't mean to be funny, but it's coming across as funny. But I seriously think we should eat it and sit on it and see what it gives us.
Maybe another way to express that is say we should chew it.
Yeah.
Chew it. Make it soft. Make it digestible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Thank you for that. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah. Well, I do suggest we drink a lot of water.
Diane?
I just wanted to say it's important when someone's angry to realize that they're in pain. I think it's important to recognize that, as that's probably what's below the emotion.
Oh, hi, Teresa.
Hi, Les, and everyone. It's nice to see you. What came up for me were two things. One is that I thought it was very helpful to sit together, to sit in silence. And the other one, I mean, to sit together, to overcome difficulties in the Sangha. The other thing, I remember something that you said when we went to San Francisco Zen Center to do a presentation about the book. Because anger can be very dangerous too. And it can harm people. And then you talk about the story of Hakuin. Somebody asked you a question in the audience about Hakuin's story. And then you said something that I always remember. You said, we have to protect the victim. So, I mean, if there is a situation where anger is gonna harm somebody, to remember to protect the victim. Thank you.
What you're saying there, Teresa, is so profound, because that so often it feels like there's this cycle in that like the reacting to or becoming angry because of the hurt, and then realizing that the action, if intentional, was often out of anger from feeling of hurt on that side that you may not fully understand. And so understanding that there are so many victims in these in that cycle, that how do we be gentle all around, that's provide that space.
I think our attitude is that when we meet with somebody who is angry, we try to understand what they need, what makes them angry, and we try to give them what they need. And it's usually in terms of attention and affection and caring, and we try to do that. And sometimes it doesn't work, that the hurt is so deep that it takes a while for our efforts to soften, and maybe it never will. There's a story about the Buddha Sangha. There was one of his students, one of his disciples, who was very angry, and eventually Buddha had to kick him out because he was so disruptive that he couldn't seem to soften in any way. But we make our best effort, holding no illusions that we're going to hit a home run every time. Okay, well, I'm looking at the clock, I see it's getting close to 9 o'clock California time. So does anybody have any final question or anything to say?
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.